Welcome to our planning session, February. Would you go ahead with roll call?
Mr. Ferguson is absent. Mr. Keller?
Here.
Ms. Savage?
Here.
Mr. Smith?
Here.
Mr. Keck?
Here.
And then we're going to skip our usual Pledge Allegiance on this meeting because we're going to do it at the next meeting. So, and that'll take us right into tonight's business.
All right. So, as you know, Todd and I have been kind of exploring options for master facilities planning, the idea of getting a nice long-term vision for the district, kind of getting a status of our buildings and kind of this comprehensive focus, but also community engagement. And so we had reached out to several districts. We've talked to some people in that field, and really Tracy and Tracy's company kind of surfaced to a group that provides that full scope and also isn't necessarily the architect and helps with community engagement and the kind of the whole scope. So we wanted the opportunity, after we've talked to him a couple times now, to have him come and share with you kind of what he's doing in other districts and give you an overview of services that are available. Okay. Sound good?
Absolutely.
I'll kick it over to you. You have the clicker, right?
I do. Yes.
All right, perfect.
Well, thank you. First of all, thanks for letting me be here tonight. I know that you always have a lot on your plate, and I know that how important this is to you. Your facilities are a big asset that you have, and the work that we do is a comprehensive approach to doing planning. I do appreciate the fact that you say that it's not an architectural approach, and I do believe that's important. I think architects have an important role in facilities. I just don't happen to think it's planning. I think that working with architects, I have all my career, they're my partners in a lot of things. They provide a lot of good insight to a lot of different things. But to do a comprehensive plan is really to give some objectivity to your goals and your needs. And so what I'm going to take you through tonight is kind of a step-by-step process. You're going to see just how iterative this process can be and why every step's important than what we do. So let me tell you a little bit about who we are. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Tracy Richter. I work for a group called HPM, but for 20 of the last 25 years, I worked for a group called DeYoung & Associates at DeYoung Richter, which is our firm. A few years back, I was able to just kind of sell the firm, take a year off. Thank God I needed a year off. But I needed to keep doing this, and I did. And so went to work for a group called HPM, which I've been planning for years. On top of that, I used to do their consulting for planning. I do have, like I said, 25 years. I'm a previous middle school teacher. I've done this now in 27 states. And I just can't believe that is even possible, but it is. I've worked at the state level. Even for the Ohio design, design manual and in other states, state level projects too. But my job is to be the lead in this. I'm the front facing person. You will see me. You will see me in front of your community, in front of your task force. Behind the scenes, you'll see Matt Sachs, and Matt's with us in Hilliard also. Matt is a GIS analyst by trade, but Matt has been doing this about almost 15 years with me now. I brought him over from my old company. And he has a specialty in data, like you can't believe. He knows how to show it well. He knows how to display it, explain it. He's a great resource, and I believe he's one of the best in the business when it comes to K-12 planning. And then there's Casey Morris. Now, Casey Morris is actually out of Texas, and he works for a group called Amoresco. Casey and I have been doing this between him doing assessment work, condition assessment work, I'll get into his stuff, we cut our teeth together in 2002 in Fort Lauderdale, Broward County. So we've been working together almost 22 or 23 years now. And so Casey and I have done this work across the country, and I believe, and not just because of that, I believe he's one of the best in the business at looking at buildings and how you evaluate buildings. And so he will give you an engineering approach to it. And on top of that, I just want you to know that we have a ton of resource behind us, and that's important because part of what we do from an engineering and assessment standpoint too is that we have pre-construction people, cost estimating people, scheduling people. The company I belong to now is actually born out of a construction company. And so we've got people that know how to do construction and not just planning. And so we bring them in on every project we do when we're doing options development, recommendations development, to make sure that the plan is constructible, like that you can achieve this plan. as you can imagine, I've got a lot of plans that I've done in this country that kind of just sit there and don't get to anything. And so I think it's important that this, you've got a ton of people behind this that you likely will never see. But they are there and they're working on this just as hard as anybody. And again, doesn't matter if you're Marysville or you're Columbus Public. I mean, it doesn't matter what size you are. We put the same amount of effort into making sure we get it right, no matter. And so understand that you never get a B team because there isn't a B team, frankly. I mean, if you get the best of it. We always think about planning from this approach: a defensible, actionable, and sustainable. All three are important. One of the tough things is trying to get people to understand data and to interpret data and see data. What I do know is that data can be interpreted a lot of different ways, and it probably should be interpreted a lot of different ways. And one of the things we're really keen on is trying to explain to your community why data can be interpreted different, and showing them the shortfalls of why data can be. That way, then they see you as very truthful, because you are. I mean, it's a very transparent process. I think that, one thing that I know a lot of school boards might be a little anxious about is being as transparent as we want to be. Like, doing this with your community and having them help build this program is not an easy thing to do, and we know that. And so, because there's a lot that can be, it's always a little messy. There's just never, how are you doing? Good. It's never not messy. Just because there's so much to do and it's so personal, schools are so personal to people. And so what I can guarantee you at some point, and I tell everybody this because I think it's important, is that in every plan I've ever done, at some point it might feel like it's coming off the rails a little bit. But that's okay. I mean, we want to, if there's truly change that's inevitable, an improvement of facilities or how programs do it, or you have to do something different in facilities, people aren't comfortable with that. And I get that, but if it's better for the district, it's better for the whole, better for the operations and the teaching and learning, and leads to good student improvement, it's okay to be a little uncomfortable. But remember, out of chaos comes order, and it always does, and it will. And so the other thing that has to be actionable, exactly what I just talked about, is that when you put together a plan that's not actionable and just kind of sits there, you might as well, look, the fact of the matter is if I didn't think that you wanted to move forward on something, I would have blithely told Diane no. I would have been, if you're not serious about this, we're not, I just won't. I've become kind of unfiltered enough to districts to say, you better be doing this, because there's plenty of work to do everywhere. So I really want to work with districts that really have this mission in place, and I know you do. And so that's why I'm really excited. And then it has to be sustainable, meaning that, looking at the plan, it's not just a 5-year plan, it has to be a 10 and 15 year vision about where you want to be. We kind of think of it like the first 5 years being tactical. What do you need to get done tactically? But after 5 years, it's hard to kind of predict exactly what you're going to need, how you're going to need it. And so in districts, no matter what size, there's kind of phases of it. And you need to allow yourself kind of an exit ramp through phases to pull off a minute, reevaluate where you are, where you've been. Are you doing it right? Are you making your metrics? Are you reaching your key performance indicators in a plan? And then get right back on and start your next phase. And so that's the sustainability of a plan, because that is going to change. I think one of the most fascinating things about this work, I think, is that it's a concurrent kind of planning thing, in that, the minute you take action on the data that you used, the data changed. And so if you're not in a continuous planning cycle, then you always fall behind. And so it doesn't do a whole lot of good to go into it and say, well, I'm going to do this review, and then in 5 years I'm going to do it again. Because you're in this continuous change that something could have happened in that 5 years that really altered everything you did. And so the hope here is that when we walk out the door in a year and a half, is that you're going to have some processes in place that if you need to call Matt to do some updating of mapping and student data and stuff, great, he's there for you. But if you can do it yourself, great, you've got the processes in place to do it. You're going to see tonight that we're going to talk about a capital planning software that allows you to be more predictive analysis in your deferred maintenance and your capital needs and even your maintenance needs. And so you can see 5, 10, 15 years out to see what your kind of measures are going to be for funding that you're going to need to do all these things. So that's a good sustainable plan, in my opinion. And so, again, I think that in this case, where the difference here is that in a plan versus a bond, is that I'm not here to do your bond plan. Okay? The first thing everybody needs is a facilities master plan. Whether you get funding or not, you need a plan. So if you get funding, you better go this way. If you don't get funding, you got to go this way. And what I find is that most districts, and when I say most, 95% of districts around this country don't have a facilities plan. And so likely what happens out of a facilities plan is you will go for an ask. And then you start your bond plan. You say, okay, what do we need to do in a bond program in order to sustain our, or in order to meet our priorities that we have for the next 5 and 10 years? And so this will be a primary focus, is that because a lot of community members are going to perceive it as, oh, they're coming after a bond. Well, you may or may not be, but I'm not making that decision for you. You're the board. You're the ones who wanted to run for this. You're stuck with it. And so that's your decision to do that. Now, you're likely going to need an ask. You've made an ask. You're likely going to need an ask at some point. And so when we get to the end of this and we prioritize what your tactical and your vision is, then you'll have a prioritized list of what the ask will be. And then you can go after a bond program if that's your choice to go after. But I wouldn't presume that that's your goal. I would presume that you would really like to have a facilities plan in place to make that decision first. And I can get you better prepared for that. So it is a very iterative plan, okay? And what I mean by that is you can see a lot of stuff going on at the same time that looks complicated, but it really isn't. Early on, getting a communications plan, when I talk about a communications plan, I'll talk about that in a minute, in a few minutes, that understanding who you're communicating to and what the message has to be. And then having a condition standard and an educational standard developed at the same time, and then being able to really give you and to put all the data together and understand it, but then to give you guys a state of the schools report. And a state of the schools report, if you can imagine, I always make an analogy of a four-legged stool, okay? And the four-legged stool is simply as simple as this. The facilities are at the top of it, right? And there are four legs to that stool. And the first one is gonna be your educational framework. And I think it's the cornerstone of your plan. Program is 70% of your plan. It's how you deliver your programs, whether it's early childhood, career and technical education, core education, what size schools you want, what grade configurations you want. The core of your plan is the guidance to the plan. And so, but there has to be buy-in of your framework. There has to be board buy-in about, you know, what size of schools do we want? What do we really want? What's the real grade configuration that works for our district? And it's different everywhere. What is our early childhood? What are our pre-K delivery model? How do we want to deliver CTE beyond just a regional program? So those are decisions that are really important because they provide, once you establish a good educational framework, you got kind of rules to plan by that. I know how many schools you need if you tell me you want 700 student station elementary schools. But that framework actually has to, I believe, has to be bought in by your community too. Not approved by them. Now, the community kind of sets aside, they're not the experts in education, they're the users of education. And I say that politely to them. But I believe that this district has hired the right people to run this district the right way. And so it is driven by that a little bit, but that's your first leg of the stool. Your second leg is going to be your demographic, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But it's not just, when I talk about demographics, it's not just an enrollment projection. It's really understanding who your students are. What type of student you're serving, when you're serving them, and how you're serving them. And so really to understand the demographic, the population trends, the birth rates, the housing, is a really critical piece to the school. And then, of course, you have condition. And condition is actually a little two-pronged. You have the physical condition of your building, which is important. Roofs, mechanical, electrical, plumbing. The envelope, the architectural features of your building are important. And you need a good condition assessment to really know what your needs are going to be. But the other piece is that you need a good adequacy assessment also, which tells you how do your buildings line up to standards. And so I'll give you an example. In Hilliard, what we did, we used the OSDM standards and we kind of modified it to Hilliard's needs. And so we measured the building against a really good, which I believe the OSDM standards are good standards. I've been across this country and frankly, they're really good compared to the rest of the country, right? But it's a good baseline standard to say, how are our spaces measuring up to the programs that we want to serve? Now, on the surface, it doesn't sound important, but when you realize that your educational adequacy and the educational improvements you have to make in your facilities can be 20 or 30% of a future bond program, well, that makes you think a little bit. It makes you think, oh my goodness, yeah.
All right, so what you're talking about is some standards that for an educational activity, you should have X numbers of square feet. Is that?
X number of square feet. You should have this adjacency. You should have these resources in the school building. You should have.
Okay.
So it's it goes in depth, actually. We have a list. Our typical classroom list is about 35 items, anywhere from temperature control to whiteboards to flooring.
Okay.
So it really is, and so those standards are really important, and we use them in two ways. We use them to measure your buildings, and we use them to give you an analysis of a prioritization too. I'm going to show you if we go a little deeper in adequacy. So that's the third leg of the school's condition. And then the fourth one is certainly funding, is, you know, what's the affordable amount that you can do? I mean, look, a facilities plan needs to address all your buildings. A bond plan is your priority of what you can afford. And so the funding mechanism comes into place, and you always have to have that in the back of your head. And so what we've learned in this, and probably why we are a little different than most, and I don't say little, we're a lot different from really any other planning organization I know, is that we don't ignore any leg of the stool. Because if you ignore one leg, it's like every bad restaurant chair you ever sat in. It's always gonna be unstable. And so, and you almost can't ever separate them. Once you start talking about programs, you can't help but think about your standards. You can't help but think about the condition of those spaces for your kids. You can't help but think how much it costs you to do it. And certainly you can't separate it from the prototype program types you want. So that's why we're gonna approach it from all those angles. And you can see that state of the schools report kind of summarizes that all for you. It synthesizes all that for you. So you as a board have kind of a one-pack information that says, here's our state based on these four conditions. Now, this is where I'm one person who has empathy for boards. You don't see empathy a lot, I'm sure. But is that the way you guys get information, everywhere gets information, is everything I just talked about, you get at different times of the year. You get enrollment in the fall, you get program information probably in the spring and summer when you're starting to ramp up your things. You get budget stuff in the spring and summer, and you might get condition stuff sprinkled through the year. Well, you're making literally millions of dollars of decisions by having points of information throughout the year instead of a centralized version of what you need to make the good decision. And so the intent of the state of the schools is to synthesize all this so you have a manual for good decision making. Now on top of that, there's a transparency glass or magnifying glass that stands over you that's called the community. And so bringing in the community aspect to it's important because those needs are important too. And it's more soft data, we know that. Oh, and there's political data too. I get all that too, I understand that. But here's the thing, is that what I've learned about any facilities master plan is that there's the data side and the community side. And if you rely too much on the community, you could ignore the data. But if you rely too much on the data, you could ignore the community. And so the trick of any good master plan, and it's the uniqueness of every school district, is kind of, what's your balance? Like, how much does the community influence? Or does the community influence a decision so much that it wrecks the entire plan? And so there might be hills you don't take. And that's okay not to take a hill if it saves the entire plan. And so, you know, good planning comes with some of those decisions that you have to make. But I'm not saying it's piecemeal in a plan. I'm saying listen to the community as you're going through the process to eliminate a piecemeal that you have to make at the end, because that makes no board member look good. And so, for me, I think it's important. I think this plan actually protects the board in a lot of ways, in that you've listened to the community, you've seen the data, you've synthesized it in one spot, and you've heard all of that, and you've been involved all the way through the process. But you've got procedure and policy in place, you've got an educational framework in place that you've already bought into that really helps protect that a little bit. And so I feel like this process has really done a good job with that from that perspective. And again, it doesn't say that it's always easy, but it does help. So one of the first things that we'll talk about is obviously your demographics, and this is, what we want to do here is we want to look at your county and the county and the school district as a whole. And we actually want to go a little deeper than enrollment projection. We're going to do some subdivision analysis. This is some, yeah, this one happens to be a map of, this was Auburn City Schools, but they had a lot of areas they could build out to. But we'll do by housing type, we'll do by subdivision, and we're going to do some yield analysis to kind of see what your trends are from where kids are coming from, where they've been. I think this is a really important piece. Of course, we're going to do an enrollment projection along with the enrollment projection you already get. We're just going to kind of do a validation of it, okay? But we're going to do a deeper dive in to see what's really going on here. And this will be good from a lot of perspectives, and because I do think that people misperceive kind of demographics like this, or they see something that's not, that they think is real, but it's not. A really good example that, again, I just finished up Hilliard. Don't know why I worked in my home school district, but I did. They tricked me into it somehow, but I loved it. I loved every minute of it. But one thing I learned about, this is fascinating to me, is that from the 2010 to the 2020 census, Hilliard grew from 29,000 to about 39,000. In the same time, we grew 350 students. That's it. Now, we've got housing growing out to the west side, like you can't believe. If you've driven on all Darby Road, done all that, you see all the housing that goes out there. And people are panicked. They're like, Bradley's gonna fill up. We don't have enough seats here. We don't have enough seats here. And look, they're just not coming. And so birth rates have plummeted. We know that. So there's a driving force of birth rates that have plummeted. You've got these 50-something year old that aren't moving out of their houses now that the kids are out. My daughter's a sophomore now downtown and at Ohio State. And our son is, you know, has an apartment, he's got a job and he's working. They're not in our house. But if you think I'm going out to get a 7.5% interest rate on a house that's half the size that costs twice as much as mine, I ain't going nowhere right now. And what you're finding is that's happening everywhere. Like, it's not just here, it is everywhere. So the empty nest thing, that gentrification phase that we've seen so frequently here, it's not happening. Now, eventually it will again. We're gonna move. I'm not gonna maintain that house for much longer, I'm telling you. I ain't got time for that. But the fact of the matter is that I looked at Dave and I said, sorry, you're not gonna get a kid out of my house for at least another 5 years. That's not an FTE you're gonna get. And so what's fascinating is a neighborhood right next to me called Lakewood, just in 2017 was generating like 1.25 kids per household. It's got about 250 homes in it. Right now it's generating 0.7. So half a kid less than 250 homes, that means 125 less kids are coming out of that, just that one neighborhood. That's a fascinating statistic to me. And so we made, and what it's done is it allowed us to go out to the community of Hilliard to say, the sky's not falling. Just because there's all this going on, because we're able to do really good analysis to see this, and we're seeing trend analysis too. And so for us, for you guys to have a deeper dive and a better grasp of, when somebody asks you about, well, why aren't you doing something here, you can look at the data and say, because it just doesn't show that we have to do anything here yet. And so I think this is a really good thing to be and do a deeper dive into your demographic. Okay? So any questions on that? I think this one, I never thought I'd like this stuff, but I really like this stuff. So the condition. Now this part is where Casey will take the lead. And so what will happen is that Casey will bring his team up here and you'll actually develop some standards for condition assessment too. So you'll work within facilities and operations and say, okay, here's, if you have construction design manuals or standard models, so this is our roof type that we use. This is our HVAC unit type that we use. So Casey will review all that with the team. He'll get it into his assessment tool. They have an assessment tool that is proprietary. What's awesome about it is that on a daily basis, they have, I don't know, 40,000 users in this thing. And so what's nice about that is cost data is always updated, and it's regionally updated, it's locally updated. So it is always in the process of being cost updated. And so once something's in there, it's in there, and it adjusts to time. Now, the other great part about their assessment software is it does predictive analysis too. So when you build a building, and you can do the same on your house, you have life cycles on every system in your house. Your roof will last 25 years, your furnace will last hopefully 20 years. You know, so you've got these life cycles, and those are predictive life cycles. And so you can literally, and Casey could literally just take your buildings and look at the age and look at the last time you replaced something. He could literally, without even taking a step in it, give you a 30-year look about what it's gonna cost you in the next 30 years. Now, obviously, there's more to it. There's a site condition analysis that you have to do to look at, you know, this roof is supposed to have 25 years, it's year 20, it's pocketed, it's this. You're gonna have to replace it sooner than later. So there's gotta be a site analysis on it too. So it's a major systems analysis on everything, and it's age and condition analysis. And then what it does is it basically analyzes what's broken, what's going to break. So it gives you a year-by-year breakdown of what it's going to cost you by system. to either maintain or replace for as long as you need it to do that. And so it's a really nice tool. And so the how they can go through that, and that's what we call life cycle modeling. They'll do the asset review, go out and do the condition assessment. And what's nice about it is that they're going to be out here probably while your principals are still in the building, and that's good news, because it's not very intrusive or time consuming for your staff. But one of the things they like to do is sit down with the principal or the field engineer or the custodian and ask them about the building. Because the problem with doing a condition assessment for one day is that you might have a leaky roof, but it's sunny that day. How would you ever know that you have a leaky roof if it's sunny that day? Or, you know, all those conditions that you don't see. In the wintertime, this happens, but they're going to be there in June. And so it's nice to get that kind of personal evaluation to say, what's really happening during the year that we might not see while we're here? And so they can adjust their assessment a little bit on that. You know, certainly there's an analysis and a QC that goes on with the district after they've collected all the data. Casey's team sits with your maintenance operations team and says, okay, this is what we found. You know, what, tell us if there's something we missed or is there something that you think is off? And so there's a quality control check before it's just not, we're gonna do it and then leave. And so there's a systems check continuously on there. And then what they do is they'll deliver you, and you can see it in any way you want, but basically it's a dashboard that this one happens to be Fort Worth because we're just working on it now as an easy one to pull up. But it gives you a school point that it acts like a Windows that you guys can use as users from operations if they want to set up just an outer facing. So if you want to go into a building and you want to see the cost by discipline or the cumulative unfunded liability of the building or the average life, the critical life of the building. So like a chart like this will show you that you can put a spending on this. So you can say, well, if we put $2 million into this, what does that do to the line? Or if I've got a continuous line in that. The other thing it does from a district-wide perspective is it allows you to see when you guys decide if you want to go for an ask. Like, if your district comes in, let's say you're at a 20% facility condition index, which is a renovation versus replacement factor, and you say, well, we think we're comfortable at 20%. We think our buildings, if we maintain 20% for the next 20 years, we think we're in good shape. And that's good, and you can do that. So what you can do is you can plug in the numbers, say, what's it gonna take on an annual basis to keep us at 20%? And so now you've got a predictive analysis to say, well, this is our usual life funding, our annual funding for maintenance and repair. Put that number in and it can show you just how quickly that line escalates. Because there is a gap that happens, and that's why you go for an ask, that nobody can afford all their need. And so your deferred maintenance keeps getting hotter and hotter and higher, and all of a sudden your gap starts to look like this over time. You want to make sure you're curbing that. You want to, if your gap starts to go up, you want to level for a while. And then keep it level, maybe take it down and then let it go and then up again. Because that's the life cycle of buildings. What this tool allows you to do is allows you to put that dollar amount in there by year to say, this will keep us on pace to keep our buildings at a level that we want. Little spoiler alert, your buildings are never gonna be at zero again. You know, the minute a school opens, it starts to escalate in condition. But and your goal shouldn't be zero. It should just be making sure first and foremost that your buildings are warm, safe, and dry. And then the second of all, that they meet performance needs that you want. And so, again, I think this tool, and it works, like I said, it works just like a Windows dashboard. You can see on the left, it looks like an Outlook page. So you can push on, and it does it by system, by discipline, by priority. There's all kinds of different ways you can look at it. I think this is going to be a very useful tool for you.
Tracy, just one thing, practically what this would do would be taking our existing PI forecast, and it would take it to a different level.
Yeah.
So just from a practical standpoint, you know, we're already doing sort of a low level of this, but like I said, this would just be the very next level, or maybe a bigger jump to a much higher level of the PI forecast.
Yeah.
And what's nice is that it's such an easy tool to use, and it's always how districts use this is different. You know, sometimes they just keep Casey on a quarterly basis, and it takes them a day to come in and update data. It says, okay, we did this HVAC this quarter, you can take this off, and then it just boom, 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 rolls it out. Or the district can maintain it themselves. And so it just depends on if you've got a person that can do that. It's a real easy software to use. So as a matter of fact, Mike McDonough runs in Hilliard, he runs it himself. Like, he knows how to use the program because it's easy to use. Not that, you know, Mike does need something easy to use, but he is so frequent in this because he's always looking at the data that in meetings, Mike would just pull it up and he'd be able to show you things. So it's a real user-friendly tool too. And again, developed by a lot of people and a lot of smart people to do this. So I think that's going to be a great tool for you. But there's, again, I think it's you determine your level of prioritization in the tool. So it's up to you to do that in your maintenance operations. You know, because it changes over time. You know, security might be the biggest thing you got worried. You might want to be putting vestibules out there. You might want to be putting more cameras out there or something like that. So you might raise that priority for a certain time. And then you can really see from the deferred backlog side even where your dollars have to be spent by priority. And so if you say that, if the district says from a condition standpoint, we think security is one of our top, well, you can just pull up what's our deferred backlog in security and what's it gonna take to fix that. Or you can do it for whatever system you want to be your priority. And so this is a moving target for everybody. And again, it's what makes every district unique in this case. Now, from the educational standards point, any question on condition? It's not gonna take long for me. I think they're gonna be in your buildings for about 8 days. You'll have three engineers walk in your building. They're not, they're all engineers. They're not necessarily, you got, you know, the PEs and then the engineers. The PEs are the professional engineers that cost a lot of money. Only bring PEs in when you need them. That's what we say. Like, if there's a specialized issue you need, and the nice part is that we've got some local guys here that if we needed to come in, they could. But these are trained engineers that see these buildings every day, walk building after building after building. And Casey is, like I said, I think between Casey's organizations that he's worked with and mine, and this sounds almost ridiculous, but between Casey and I, we've, and the companies that we work for and led, we've seen 1 in 8 schools come in this country. And so we know our buildings, we know how to get through them. I think I wouldn't bring somebody not trustworthy, and I trust Casey inherently with this. You're going to get a really good product here. So I'm really confident, and I'm excited for you to have this level of information. Now, the part that we'll cover more is the educational standards and specification and getting your adequacy. You know, first and foremost is really kind of determining and aligning those specifications. So what I have said here is that the first thing we'll do is we'll likely align the Ohio School Design Manual first because it's a good Ohio standard based, and then we'll take any modifications that Marysville wants on that standard. And so, again, I'm going to jump to Hillier because it's so familiar, that we went out to their new middle school. We had the OSDM standard in our collection tool. We went through the middle school because they just built it a few years back. They said, this is our standard for this, this is our standard for this. We just make a quick change in it. And the other piece of this is that how we do this is that we have, like I said, by space type, we've got every school space type you can imagine. We have every standard you can imagine on a level. And what we'll do is we'll sit down with the district, we'll sit down with curriculum and facilities, and we'll say yes, no on every one of these things. So we'll get your secondary academic leader and we'll say, okay, we're gonna walk these spaces. They're gonna look down at the standards and say, no, we don't need this, no, we don't need this, or yes, we need this, this, and this. And we can modify it to you. And again, what this does is it looks at all those visions and missions you have, your pedagogies and how you do it. Pedagogy is going to be important. I'll talk about that in a minute. Recognizing what you do in your classrooms and how you want to practice in your classrooms. And I think that's a big deal. And then it creates those benchmarks to measure your buildings. So not only will you have a good standard, so the next time you want to build something or renovate something, you'll have a standard to do that to. So you'll have a document to hand over to the architect to say, this is how we build buildings here. Now design them. Instead of them coming in and saying, this is how we build buildings, how are your standards? Because I think that happens a lot. And we don't want that, we want you driving that. So that includes things like space type, square footage, and all those resources in there. And I will tell you that when you go into an evaluation like this, what's fascinating to me is that everyone I've seen in the country, on an educational accuracy or suitability, whatever you term you want to use here, every firm I've ever seen gives you a good, fair pour, red, yellow, green light. And I'm sitting there trying to figure out how in the heck you make a decision on a yellow light adequacy evaluation. I don't even know what that means. pause, slow down. I have no idea. And so we spent a lot of time, and when I say a lot of time, a lot of time and internal resources, building the tool that allows us to, and you can see everything you're kind of looking at, furniture, acoustics, flexibility, outdoor spaces, you know, color. We don't have to look at color necessarily, but if color is an important piece to identification of space, we can do that. We can do a lot of different things. And so this is really conditioned to you. And so you can see there's so many things that we can put in here to understand this. Now, here's a differentiator, and this is important, is that if every building was an ideal building, it'd be 100%. It would line up to every standard you wanted for your space, for your programs, right? Well, again, spoiler, there's no building in the country that does that, okay? No, the perfect school's never been built because programs change so frequently. I say all the time, in 7 years of teaching middle grades education, I taught under three different pedagogies of middle grades education. I had a 700 square foot classroom with 13 foot hallways, and I changed the pedagogy three times. So buildings don't necessarily align. You know, we adapt and we overcome and do this. So when we're measuring buildings, if you think about an ideal score being 100%, like this, everything matches to the standard, we have in a building what we call constructible standards and non-constructible standards. And those constructible standards are things that can be reasonably fixed with construction. Things like technology, furniture, like that's not construction, but it's construction-like. So furniture can be fixed. There's mechanical things in the rooms that can be fixed. There's projectors, there's whiteboards. Those are easily constructible things. But there are also things in a building that what we consider non-constructible that are part of an adequacy assessment that should be measured. And so it's things like a non-constructible standard could be things like class size, classroom size. Because the without reasonable construction means that you then get out of a like-to-like analysis. So follow me on this. Is that if my standard for a classroom is 900 square feet, and I walk into a building that says then every classroom is 700 square feet, we might call that a non-constructible standard. Now, we can put a cost on it, and the cost is building you more square footage to get you to a higher average, right? Or a replacement cost. But what we can't do is we can't tell you that, what it's gonna take in order to get those classrooms 900, you're gonna take four classrooms, you're gonna make it three. Or you're going to take whatever, 4 to 3, 3 to 2, whatever it is. And the minute you did that, you changed the capacity and the program delivery model in that building. I don't have as many spaces, and I might jeopardize the types of space I have to teach in. So it's not a like-to-like analysis, and your assessment has to be a like-to-like in your standards to your buildings. And so we might call that a non-constructible standard. But what we can do is we can say, okay, this is what we could do. We could build a new cafeteria and then wipe out a bunch of rooms and give you the same capacity. We could do that. Or there's other, that's options development and how you build a master plan. And so what happens in this is that you see that you're gonna get buildings that are going to have a maximum score according to your standard, a constructible and non-constructible score. And the difference between constructible and non-constructible is your maximum score. And you're gonna see it in a minute. But what this is gonna tell you is that you're gonna get an evaluation of each one of your buildings, and you're gonna see that, hey, this building's a 65% on the adequacy, on the constructible adequacy. It's the maximum score it could get before messing with additions or renovation, major renovation, or gutting the building. And you're gonna look at that, and you're gonna say, okay, this building has a 70% FCI and a 60% adequacy. Is this building really worth putting the dollars in to keep if it's only going to be ever measured to get 60% of your SCR? And so for you, it's a defensible tool. It says that, why would I throw all this money into a building that will never reach our educational program standards that we want? And it's a prioritization tool for you too. And so you can use it as that. So let me show you what it means. So this is, for instance, again, this is Hillier because this is easy, we just did it. So you can see that most buildings come in that you can see their maximum score in the gray, between the gray and the blue is constructible versus non-constructible, okay? And so, like Alton-Darby, well, let me go to the newest school. So you go to Hillier Memorial, right here. So Hillier Memorial has been open 3 years now. Its maximum score right now is 97%. It's brand new, it's built to their standard that they wanted, but it's not 100%, they never can get to 100%. Because they've already made alterations in special education spaces and those type of spaces. And then it shows you can see that the ideal cost is the ideal cost to replace the building, but then you have a constructible, non-constructible cost. And so you can see that there are non-constructible factors. Again, things like my standard is to have a bus loop and a car loop, and I only have a bus loop. We might, because the site restricts it, it might not be able to be built. So like Brown Elementary, right here. If you've ever been out by Bradley High School, it's that small little brown building on the, like the one room schoolhouse on the corner right there. It literally only has that one loop in. And unless you completely take out the playground in the back and you can't build on the land to the right, there's no way to put a car loop in there too. But what we do measure is how much asphalt it would take to build a new car loop. But it's a non-constructible standard. So you can see even a little school like Brown Elementary can only get to 60%. And I go across here, my non-constructible is $10.5 million on my building. So if you want to get that building to a program standard, you not only have to put this $2 million in, you would have to put $10 million in and completely change the program delivery of that building. And so what this adequacy does now for you is allows you to see, at what point do I not want to invest back into a building from a programmatic standpoint? Or is it going to take, so then, because a lot of people will say, well, I do that condition assessment, that tells me how much I need. Well, that's only half the story. You got to build, so what if you need an addition on the building? What if you need to take out program spaces, or what if you need to do that? That's, again, master planning. But you can see how effective this tool can be, and then now it even gets better, is that I can show you now by program area how much money we've got to spend. And so you can see, for instance, I always pull out things like special education, blue dot right here. So if I go across the district, I can see I got about, there are about $0.8 million of efficiencies in their special education space types, okay, from this assessment. They do pretty well because they've adapted their spaces pretty well. But a lot of the majority stuff is on their campus. You know, whether it's parking spaces, whether it's bus loops, whether it's playgrounds, whether it's, a lot of it's wrapped up in that. And so you guys can say, as a school board now, you can say, okay, in this plan, we want to address deficiencies in our special education. We see that they're big there. We need to allocate this much in our bond program or in our next budget cycle to fix these program areas from this. And so not only do you get a building level, now you get a program level. And so I can break this out into a lot of different levels. And I can also do, and this is a dashboard for it, I can also do it by category, furniture, mechanical, circulation, your physical, your plumbing. You can do it by priority. So again, Hilliard's is life safety first, and then the last one is kind of cosmetic. Okay, so those are your colors or things like that if you want to put that in there. And then you can see it by program area, by school. So you have a working dashboard that you can show to your public to say, this is a real need from a program side. And it's an outfacing dashboard that's very transparent for you. And so this is actually what kept Hilliard from getting their plan done about 6 months sooner. They decided that they didn't have enough information to make good decisions on their facilities. And this was kind of a differentiator in this. And I think it's, again, it's a very good tool. And you can see it's not a red, yellow, green light. This is real information that you can really use to make really good decisions and budgeting for your facilities. Pair that with your conditioning tool. Now, here's the good news, is that within the Ameresco Space Asset Planner is a tool called Space Planner. That's where we put this data. So they're both in the same program. You just get a dashboard with this one and you get a dashboard with the other one. They can be separate or together. So it's a really cool tool for you. And as complicated as it looks, it's not. It's complicated for us because we got to get data. For you guys, it's push button, boom, 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 you're seeing it. So it's very user-friendly for you. And again, we just did Worthington like 2 years ago. We didn't have these tools for Worthington. So this is how fresh this is and good it is. And the data is really good in there. The other thing on the adequacy is we're going to do a real capacity utilization analysis for you. A room by room, hour by hour, use of space. So you can really see how buildings are being used in your district from an hourly perspective. This one's interesting because it's really kind of breaking down how you define capacity and how you want to define capacity. I will tell you, there's probably 1,000 different formulas for capacity, and I'm not kidding you when I tell you that. Capacity may be the top three things debated in my career in the last 5 years. You know, it's amazing how many schools from 1960 held 3,500 kids, and they never did hold 35, but people think they did. But it's really, what's nice is that you can see how we mark this. But like, you'll get this for your high school, and it's going to show you an hour by hour use of your high school on peaks and valleys of usage of space. And you can see, so like when a principal tells you at a high school level, like my building's full, and on paper it just kind of looks like it's full. Like you say, I have 1,200 kids, I have 1,500 seats. Why are you full? Well, because periods 1, 2, and 3, you're using 95% of your rooms. And period 4 and 5, when everybody's at lunch, you're using 40% of your rooms. And then 7 and 8, you're using all your rooms again. And then some classes have 40 in them, some have 15, some have 12. It's just, it's a good way to see kind of how buildings are being used through this. And so I think this is an important tool for us to measure exactly what your buildings will be able to hold in time. And then the other thing is that this is a good tool for analyzing that, utilization just isn't how many students and how many seats you have, and it shouldn't be. The problem with that is that a lot of times classroom matters, how many classrooms you have matters. I go back to Worthington 7 years ago when we first started their plan. We looked at their elementary utilization from a student seat capacity, and we saw there was like 80% utilization across the district. And everybody thought, well, we got some room for some, maybe consolidation, maybe after. And then we did the evaluation, and we were told that we don't always trust what the principal says, and we really do the evaluation of it, although they're great. We went in, and we found out that there is literally one empty classroom in their 13 buildings for elementary schools. One. Even though they showed like an 81% utilization. And what you come to learn is that kids don't come in perfect packages of 25. And so one school is a great example that, let's say your class size is 25. Well, I've got 62 kids in a cohort. So I'm not going to put 25, 25, and 12. I'm not going to do that. You're going to do 20, 21, 21, and 21. Which tells me in the third grade you have 12 empty seats. Well, what if I have 12 empty seats here and 12 empty seats in fourth grade and 14 empty seats in second grade? And so all of a sudden I'm getting these empty seats, but I'm not putting fifth graders in first grade rooms. And so the room by room utilization ends up being just as important as the seat utilization you're building. So you see how data can be deceiving? Because it is deceiving. And so you really have to do a deeper dive when it comes to this. And so that's what we're gonna do for you. And then finally, community engagement. Yeah, working internally with the district team, we wanted to put together a community task force for you that is a representative of your community. 25 people that come together 5 or 6 times during the process. There used to be what we called a steering committee. They review data for us. They help, they help in options development. They're not an authority position that makes recommendations. The superintendent makes the recommendations. You approve a plan, but they advise on them. They're the ones who are data checking us, fact checking us. They're looking at the state of the schools. They're saying, hey, something doesn't look right here. Or this is what's going on in our neighborhood. And they're really the voice of the community. They also help when we go out to larger community settings. They'll be helping carry the banner in that. Doing a 2-scale meeting, which means we're not sure how that's going to look yet or how it should look. It's been different over time. We found a lot of success, and sometimes you go out and you have a larger meeting for the community to come to and listen to the data and get some back and forth input on. But then we followed up with 7 or 8 miscellaneous time focus times online. Sign up at noon, 5 and 8 o'clock at night for get online, talk to the consultants about the plan, give your input. We found that to be very successful. And that's kind of easy because we find it to be productive because we have a conversation with citizens. You're actually getting an answer instead of just talking. And so, and then of course your role as a board is, obviously keeping us in line with policy, your policy and how that works. And, but at some point getting the framework review is gonna be on you guys to make sure, we buy into this because this is the direction that we've been given advice on. Or you say, wait a minute, let's not go that direction. When we do options, and our first stage of this is how do you develop options because there are different pathways to it, you'll review that to say, does this option really work, or I don't like the way that looks, when we start making recommendations, we might want to avoid that. You guys should have a say in that too. And so as we get to that, and then obviously it's going to be ultimately your responsibility. And again, it depends on how you want to do it, but I typically tell boards to accept a master plan. Don't adopt it because there's so many different variables, but to accept a master plan as your guiding principle. And then within that, when we build a bond plan for you, if that's what you want at the end of this, you can approve a bond, you know, a bond decision. But just accept a plan, and then you can use it as your guideline for the next 5 years in your tactical. So that'll be the role there. But we also think that there's different levels of communication. I'm almost finished here. Is that we have to have a different conversation internally. How that message is going with operations, with the superintendent and her cabinet, how we talk to the board and how we talk to the community. And so it's not the same communications plan, and it can't be. And so we develop kind of different pathways on how we do that. How many times are we going to meet with you? Are we ever going to meet with you one-on-one? Are we going to, when we have to, when you guys want to sit down and kind of look through it as just a more detailed question and answer, stay within sunshine laws, do all that kind of stuff. Are we going to meet with you in business meetings? Are we going to meet with you in business meetings? All those are really important on how you display this kind of communications out there and how you guys get information too. And so we really do a big kind of look at communications. We intend to start this in May, which I think is a good time to start it. We talked about this a couple months ago, even when, you know, when is a good time to start? Well, it is a good time to start. To start getting all the data together, to get the assessments done in the summertime, you know, all that together, developing our framework, and right when school starts up, start getting the buy-in on the framework, you know, get the community engaged in. This is what we think our district should look like from an educational perspective. Let's get a survey out there. Let's talk to people about getting buy-in. Let's come back to you as a board. Let's update the data one more time because you're going to get new enrollment data. Let's do that one more time. It's also a good time to start meeting with the task force in this. We likely will meet with the task force early in the fall. First meeting will be about process and data, and we'll get them in kind of ingrained in that. Then we'll take them into how we're going to do options and have them, if they want to volunteer, to come in and do a workday session with options with us, they can. But ultimately, getting to a board deliverable sometime, probably early spring next year for you. It's a very comfortable timeline. It's not, you know, our task force won't be feeling like it's shoved down their throat. You guys will have a lot of time to review data and make good decisions in it. And we have plenty of time to meet in between. And so I think the schedule actually lays out really nicely. And it really hits a good time for us. It hits a really good time for assessment. And for Casey's team, it's a really good time for assessment. I was talking to him about it, and I'm like, look, this is about a couple weeks of out on site for you guys at this time. He goes, that's perfect. He goes, all these big districts want to do this like in the fall and winter. And so they're like really slammed all the time, like from September to like March. They're all working. Like it's hard to get them. So when we were kind of going through the schedule, Casey's like, this is so good. He goes, we will have so much focus time on this. I'm like, that's what they want. So that's good. So the timeline work looks good. Feels good. You can tell that there's a lot of work to do, and it's pretty comprehensive. And sometimes I feel like I'm the old Matchbox car commercial guy talking through this, but there's a lot of information to get within like 45 minutes or an hour. But you can see just how important this is to us doing it right for you guys. So, with that, any questions you might have? Go ahead. I can go back.
You've identified your data collection and assessments and all those kinds of things. Is there a place in all of that process for the teachers, staff to say this is working and this isn't working in terms of space, or I wish I had? And I know you've talked about that there are standards and so forth, but just hearing, you know, from the staff, you know, it's hard for us to communicate with this particular layout, or, you know, we always run short on storage space, that kind of thing.
So, and one of the things that we do is that, and what's nice in the virtual world, it's been easier for teachers to do this, is that we'll do like subject area interviews. Like I'll get your special ed leadership and teachers on a Zoom call, or I can come in person, either way. And we go through a series of questions about, you know, what are you missing? What do you, like, according to how your teaching standards are, what do you want in this assessment? So that's a very important part of building the standards for us.
Yeah. I just didn't.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, probably, you know, those little details.
My question was, you know, is that embedded in some of the things that you kind of highlighted
it
for
is.
Us?
And it's important to get that input. I think that, you know, what's interesting about this process, and what you're going to find about me, I'm very truthful with you all the time, is that what's hard to get teachers to do is to see forward. Is that, you know, there's a lot of teachers say, you give me one more four-way plug in, my life would be so much easier. And there's so much in the weeds, it's hard to get them to, like, I could say this coming from the teaching profession, that sometimes I think that if teachers never get out of the classroom, I think that, you know, if teachers are pioneer, Pittsburgh would be the far west. Because they're just trying some days to get to 315 with no resources in their room. And so, give me a better projector. And that would make education so much better. And I'm thinking, no, you could have so much more. Yeah. And so, the tough part in that is to get teachers to think forward.
Yeah.
And so, but the nice part about it is that how we conduct interviews and how I conduct interviews is I do push them. I'll push them to where they need to get to. To a point, sometimes I feel a little uncomfortable because they should. They should feel like, oh, I might never do that. And then all of a sudden they're thinking, maybe we should do it that way. Or they think, oh, that's cool, but what if I did it like this? So they think a little differently. And if we can do that and push it just that one step next, and I know, look, at 7 years, I've never thought I would think like I think in schools by being in the classroom. But they never get the opportunity to do it either. So I get excited about those interviews. But yeah, I've also got some scars for it. You know, those old librarians. they're awesome. But you have to get their input to see kind of where they're going. So that is the thing, and I'm sorry to cover that. But that's where that pedagogy thing comes into place.
Right.
And understanding that.
Yeah. I knew something that I wanted to ask.
And I think it's interesting on pedagogy too, like middle schools and this capacity one. Like one of the questions I always ask, especially with middle grades, is that utilization of a building on how you teach middle grades is important. Like if I'm in a team teaching model, efficiencies of buildings can go out the window. They're using about 2/3 of your building most of the time from a core classroom standpoint. But that's okay because if you're teaching that pedagogy is very good in middle grades. But if I'm in a junior high model, I can get 90% utilization of my building. And so that matters. Pedagogy matters on how you look at buildings. And so, but I'm fortunate I'm an educator and understand that. And I've had that little bit of training in that. So.
I really like the reporting tools that you've shown, the capacity utilization. I think that's great. I'm very excited to see the process coming off because we're definitely at that time, but this will help us communicate very clearly. You know, and I love it. So
good. I'm glad you guys are excited about that part. I think you're a district that needs to set the standard in that. I do. I think that people see you as a forward-thinking district anyway. I mean, you've got industry here that is world internationally recognized. You should have the same tools they're using to do it. I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Community survey, is that to everybody or just to the task force?
No, the task force serves as kind of that core base, but the community is the broader community. How we decide to communicate them, like I said, maybe we're going to do a couple meetings at the high school or something. We'll bring them together to show them what the plans or the options are. But we'll also throw out surveys out online too. And so user-friendly surveys, not complicated surveys that have good descriptors with them to get as much input as we can. But one of the important things will be to really stress this educational framework piece to get out to the community, to get buy-in on that. Because again, that educational framework is going to set our rules for planning. And because you're always going to have somebody at the end say, well, I didn't know you were doing this. We're going to provide plenty of opportunity, whether they're online focus groups, whether they're community surveys or larger community meetings. The one question we'll have to ask is, how do you want to invite your community task force? Like, how do you want to do that? And that's, again, every district's different. I'm working with one district that put an application online, said, if you're interested, you got to fill out this application. And I've had several districts do that, and I actually think that's not a bad idea, because if you're going to take time to fill out an application to be on a committee, you're probably going to commit to the committee.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea.
I kind of thought a little bit along that line as you were going through your presentation, because it would allow you to tap into different backgrounds and expertise and make sure that you by having at least a bit of selection in the process that you can make sure that you touch a variety of different groups and
yep.
people within your community, and not all of the task force comes from this neighborhood
yep.
or that yep. neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I also wrote down two other things just early on as you were presenting this. One is that having you or someone in your profession do this in terms of the evaluation helps to eliminate personal and local, what I've labeled local bias, because I know if I'm sitting in a group, I have a picture of what our community looks like, and that picture may or may not be real accurate. Having people from the outside coming in and looking at Marysville from a cleaner slate without preconceived ideas about the community, I think would help the school district move forward
yes.
and better utilize things. And in our current situation right now, the other huge factor is that our administration is stretched very thin. And as smart and as educated and knowledgeable as they are, they're not necessarily smart and educated and knowledgeable in the areas that facilities planning requires. And so there's an expertise that's being brought in. I don't think our administrators have sufficient time to dedicate to
yeah.
the level of work that needs to be done to get this right.
Yeah.
And in terms of their daily schedule, they have other things which are higher priorities.
Right.
And your people coming in have only one priority, and that is to do this type of work. So I'm excited that our superintendent and our treasurer have brought you to the table.
Appreciate that.
Because I think, you know, they're great people, but they need help with this.
They got full-time jobs, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Yeah. The task force, this is probably more a question for them. Have you thought about, are we going to tap into something we already have? Are we going to have an application process?
Yeah, I mean, one tool that's been effective is to reach out to like Memorial and ask them for one volunteer. You know, so we'll probably do that with some of our larger groups, like Chamber, maybe one person. But then I think we also talked about the application as well. We've seen that as an effective way to, like, if you're going to take the time to fill it out.
Right. It means something to you.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yep. But I think we've found some good leverage from just saying, hey, Chip, we're looking for one person. Pick somebody and he'll from the hospital, and he'll send someone. So then we're not hand-picking
right. Either.
Yeah. That's a really effective
strategy. Current facility plan, do we have one? Sorry.
No, there's never been one.
Right. Most, to be honest, I don't know that any district besides one I was a part of had one.
Yeah.
So,
so we, a couple years
Jeff
ago.
Jeff Wargrace had.
Well, a couple years ago, we engaged with a pretty large PI project because we also didn't have a forecast for our PI. I think when I first got here, when you came on, that's all right. And so that was kind of our first step in kind of thinking that way. But we've always known in 2029 the bonds fall off. And our hope has always been, you know, right now we're still trending okay in space. But as we know, you know, there's several developments in the works. So 2029 is lining up to be an ideal time to potentially put on a no new millage type of ask when the high school bonds fall off. So it's kind of always been in our mind around this time frame we could roll out that larger plan. We've kind of negated the need for a second high school, obviously, by starting the STEM school, which is going to be your most expensive endeavor. So that's been a win. But we obviously have concerns, middle school, Creekview being the only option at those grade levels.
I have a question. You can check me if this is off pace here, but like redistricting, immediate like needs for redistricting, is that something that you will look at? Or
so part of what we'll look at from the master planning standpoint, if there's a recommendation to alter boundaries, we would make a recommendation to do that. I would not put a boundary process within a facility master plan.
Okay, those are two separate processes.
They are. I think you determine what your portfolio is going to look like, and then you do your boundary process, and then you engage your community in a different way that way.
Gotcha.
So one informs the other.
And we've always waited till that enrollment comes in kind of thing before we've looked at boundaries as well. Try to line that up.
Any other quick questions? Because we're going to need to adjourn to get to the next meeting.
Okay.
So moved. Is there a second?
Oh, sorry.
That's right.
You all want to stay here? Is that what you're telling?
No, I can second.
Oh, thank you. It's been moved to the second. We adjourn this work session.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mr. Keller?
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson?
Yes.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Keck?
Yes.
I thought it was all yes. Yes.
We need to change the rule.
All in favor, say aye.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.